On the first problem of the quiz, there were a number of things that I saw, some of which were counted as a mistake, some of the things I just ended up correcting in the way of suggestion, but the small problems I found with going to line structures. So first, if you're formally going all the way to a line structure, in this particular example, you would have gotten rid of all of the carbon labels. So particularly for the triple bond, some of you were nervous about getting rid of the carbon labels for the triple bond because you weren't sure, I guess maybe, that you were going to be able to show that you had a single bond that then stopped and then turned into a triple bond. It's like, well, how do you show there's an atom there? We do it the same way that I had drawn in the examples in class, where you just draw that single bond, and then you can switch to a triple bond. Someone reading the structure would automatically know, oh, there is a carbon there where it goes from the single to the triple. So you didn't need to include any of the carbons. Although in some of your cases, depending on what exactly it was you were doing, I might have gone ahead and accepted that as an answer. The one thing you can't do is you cannot leave out the hydrogens on nitrogen and oxygen, because this line structure system is a system for writing carbons. And so any presumptions that we make about hydrogens being there or not, we only do that with carbon. So you had to write the ones on the oxygen and nitrogen in. Let me just draw the answer. So there's our carbon framework. We've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 carbons. And again, you can see that the way that I made sure to show the triple bond. One related mistake that probably was caused by that triple bond is a few of you left the carbon where my pen currently is out, where the oxygen attaches. Some of you tried to attach that in the same position as the triple bond. When attaching that oxygen, you do show a bond. So you cannot just write oxygen at the top of the peak here. You actually have to write a bond to it. The only place where you could have simplified maybe is if you did the same thing like what I did in lecture, which is where I write the O and the H right next to each other. Because that's a functional group, because it's so common, if you didn't put a bond in there, it was okay. And then for the other side, we would need to have the nitrogen. Now, it is the nitrogen that is attached to that carbon. So if you write NH2, N first, H second, well, I understood what you meant, but normally you would write it this way, H2N, again to make sure that the bond is ending to the atom that really is making that connection. Since that's not a rule or a thing to watch out for that I had told you about ahead of time, I didn't mark any points off if you did write NH2. But this is the more correct way to do it. But of course, if we had the nitrogen here, where we wrote it right where the bond is, then you could write NH2, no problem. But any questions then on generating the line structure from this full molecule? Well, then let's look at the other direction. So starting out with a line structure. Oops, no nitrogen there, nitrogen up there. If we want to write this out, we should write all the hydrogens in if we're really making a full structure. So some of you wrote the carbons in but didn't put the hydrogen. Let's figure out how many carbons there are, though. We've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 carbons. Then the hetero atoms, since you never leave those out, whatever you see, you just write. So some of you tried to do something strange with the carbon-oxygen double bond. You tried to put another carbon in. So on the other side of the double bond, if you have an oxygen, then that is the atom that's located there. You don't insert a carbon like that and make a new bond to the oxygen.
So translating between the line structure here, the only thing that changes is there is the carbon that you write in, and because that carbon currently only has three bonds showing to it, we need to put a hydrogen in as well. Looking at the other positions on the molecule, the middle carbon already has a double bond and two single bonds to it, so we don't need hydrogens on it, so it's fine. The next carbon over, the first bond, the first carbon of that triple bond, again, already four connections to it, don't need a hydrogen. So only the end carbon will need a hydrogen, as well as the carbon up top that also only had three connections before I threw that hydrogen in. So questions at all about the line structures? Then moving to question two. You're asked to draw an S and P orbital of any energy level and shade your drawing appropriately and explain what the shading represents. And I left this wording a little bit intentionally vague so I could see whether you would choose the right shading system or not. For atomic orbitals, since we're normally going to be writing them to show how bonding occurs, exactly the reason we wrote them in class the first time through, normally you write them to show the sign of the wave function. And so if you're doing that, an S orbital would be whatever color you happen to choose, and then a P orbital would have two different halves, one colored differently than the other. If you said that one half is plus and one half is minus, that's not a complete answer. Plus what? Minus what? I might think that you're thinking of charge. If you said plus or minus phase, of what? Plus phase of what? Minus phase of what? The complete answer is the plus and minus sign of the wave function. So one of those is when the wave function itself is negative and when the wave function itself is positive. Now, I know that we also had smog diagrams in which the orbitals had shading not according to phase, but we weren't using those smog diagrams in bonding like we were with atomic orbitals. So if you go back and look chronologically when we encountered these topics, the only form of shading I had shown you with atomic orbitals was to shade according to sine of the wave function. Now, what's the difference between a sigma bond and a pi bond? Well, if you said a sigma bond is for S orbitals and a pi bond's for P orbitals, that's wrong. Because P orbitals can be oriented so that they're pointed at each other. P orbitals can make sigma bonds, as we saw in the diagram that I wrote when I taught what is a sigma bond and a pi bond. So if you just said sigma bonds are for S orbitals, pi bonds are for P orbitals, that's not a complete description. A complete description would be that the sigma bond is when you have head-to-head overlap, when you have it such that the bond, when you rotate it, remains exactly the same. So that could be between S orbitals, but as we saw in smog diagrams, it could be between an S orbital and an SP3 orbital, or an SP2, or an SP. Or even before the smogs, we again saw that P orbitals, if they're in line, form sigma bonds. What's the difference then between a sigma bond and a pi bond? Well, pi bonds would be parallel overlap, sideways overlap, which so far we've only seen P orbitals doing. But again, you can't just say P orbitals because they can overlap in two different geometries. So the real answer, in fact, therefore focused on the geometry of the bonds, whether it's in a line or whether it's in a line of meaning head-to-head or whether you have sideways overlap. So questions about that problem? Third one then. Most of you got that correct except for some small issues with terminology or language. So a functional group is not a molecule. Because if you say that a functional group is a group of molecules on a molecule, there's no such thing. There's a group of atoms that are part of a molecule, that group has reproducible or predictable behavior no matter what molecule it appears on. So just a small number of you used molecules instead of atoms, which I can't count that correct because atoms and molecules are two very different things. As far as examples of functional groups, most of you did alcohols or carboxylic acids. Some of the functional groups that we saw the first or second lecture.
There were a couple of random answers, though. Someone did alkene, someone did aldehyde. So as long as what you wrote was correct, then that was fine. Now, question four, I'm sure that some of you are going to have questions how I graded it. So let me try to clearly explain what I was going for here. You were told that a bond is lower in energy, and you're told that an antibond is higher in energy. And you're asked, why is this true? If you said a bond is lower in energy because it releases energy, you just told me a bond is lower in energy. But you didn't tell me why. If you'd said that an antibond destabilizes the molecule, and that's why it's higher in energy, but why is it destabilized? There's no concrete answer in that answer. If you tell me that anything to do with the atoms getting closer or further away from each other, you were describing the classical model of bonding, which the whole point of going over the classical model was to show that it's wrong, that it doesn't describe what's going on. And so here's the real reason. A bond is lower in energy because electrons are placed between nuclei. And the more that you get plus and minus charge to interact, the lower the energy of the system. If you have an antibond, you have a node that is between the two atoms. The node means there's no electrons there, and so the nuclei are just experiencing the repulsion of each other. That is high energy, and that's why an antibond is higher in energy. Some of you had the right answer and then went a little too far. You said it was to do with electrons being between bonds or not being between nuclei. But remember that our way of modeling the bond and the antibond, where we add or subtract orbitals, that doesn't happen in real life. Some of you answered that way. I accepted your answer as correct because you had so much the rest of it right. But realize that when two atoms approach, it's not that the orbitals add and subtract. That's what we do on paper to make things that look like the bonds and antibonds. What happens physically is just the wave's pattern changes because of the influence of the two nuclei. So I know it's kind of a subtle point, but it's one that we'll keep coming back to, that these models are all fake. So again, the real answer should have been a bond is lower in energy because the bonding orbital places electrons between nuclei, increasing interaction of plus and minus charge. The antibond is higher in energy because the molecular orbital has a node where there are not electrons between nuclei, which means the nuclei are exposed. Yes, it's true the nuclei are going to repel, but again, that doesn't have anything to do with distance per se. It's not that the atoms get too close and now there's an antibond. No. When you form a bond, that fixes the distance between nuclei. And then if you have an antibond, it's for that same distance. That distance will disappear if you make an antibond filled, because then you'll break the molecule apart, which is the next part of the question. Why is hydrogen a molecule but He2 is not? If all you did was to write this diagram, something like this, or even if you labeled it, how do I know from that you know what the answer is? Yeah, you know the diagram, but what's the meaning of it? You have to tell me that in hydrogen, only a bonding orbital is filled. And that lowers the energy of the system. That's why a bond forms. For helium, the bond and antibond orbitals are filled. So the antibond cancels out whatever stabilization the bond had, and then that's why the molecule won't form. Last question. So you had, and I know this is picky, but this is the whole point of this first quiz, to show you what kind of questions am I going to ask and what kind of answers do I expect. So first part of that last question says, why do atomic orbitals fail to describe a molecule? The why is not because they're not all the same energy and because the geometry's wrong. That's how they fail. But the why they fail is because atomic orbitals only exist with exactly one nucleus. If you have multiple nuclei, you don't have atomic orbitals. That's why they fail. The examples you were asked for, that was the second part of the question, were related to methane. Methane is the example that I did tackle in class to show that, yeah, p orbitals have the wrong geometry. Methane's 109.5, p orbitals are 90 degree angles. Atomic orbitals are different in energy. The bond orbitals in methane are all equal. So those are the two ways in which you see how atomic orbitals fail. Well, how do you make hybrids then? The how is not count up the number of sigma bonds and lone pairs. That's how you know how many hybrids. But the hybrids themselves are created by adding and subtracting atomic orbitals. So I know many of you had what you thought was a right answer, but had some little technical point marked off. Realize it's not necessarily so technical. It's just in chemistry, like in any science, you've got to be very precise with what you're saying. And again, this is so that you have an idea now how to answer or what to answer when we get to an exam. Question about anything related to the quiz? Well, then let's talk about wrapping up the end of the experiment, because we had gone over last time parts A and B, but let me remind you what parts A and B are. Part A, you have the hydroxide layer, which is where the benzoic acid was located. And then you had the ether layer, the organic layer, that had what was called the neutral compound, the naphthalene. You also had an ether layer with a neutral compound, the naphthalene, for part B. But in part B, you also had two aqueous layers. One that was the bicarbonate, the weaker base that targeted the stronger acid, benzoic acid. So benzoic acid for part B is in the bicarbonate layer, not the hydroxide layer. For part B, the hydroxide layer was used second to get out the naphthol, the two naphthol. So you have five different things you isolated. The two samples of benzoic acid, you should have gotten their masses separately, but then everything else that you do with them, you do combined. So you combine the benzoic acid, you'll do the recrystallization combined, which hopefully most of you have already finished, and then you'll do a melting point only of that combined recrystallized benzoic acid. So even if the directions tell you to, don't do a melting point before recrystallization. I'm trying to reduce how much melting point we do because it's boring. And you've already done it in your Chem 1 classes. For the other materials, you just need the mass. No recrystallization, no melting point. And then when you're done, the benzoic acid and naphthol can go into the acid waste because they're acids. And the naphthalene being neutral could really go in either one, but we'll just throw it into the base waste. We're not saving the samples once you're done with the lab. Now, what about melting point? Well, let's talk just briefly about melting point theory. And this won't be as in-depth as some of you might have experienced when if you took Chem 1A from me. But most solids have what kind of internal structure? If I had one word that I wanted to describe solids as, there's one particularly good word. I think someone said crystal? It's correct, actually. What does crystalline mean? The what, I'm sorry? Uniform geometric arrangement. Now, when we think of the word crystal, we think of some kind of bling on a ring, right? But that just means that you've got a large amount of that solid that's very highly ordered throughout the solid. Crystalline, in terms of solids, does not mean sparkly kind of crystal. It means that geometrically, the molecules are in a very regular pattern. In fact, the Nobel Prize that just got won this year has something to do with crystal patterns. Just to try to explain in 20 seconds what that is, crystallographers, people that study crystals, used to think that in order for something to qualify as a crystal, that shape had to exactly repeat somewhere along in the structure. So if you took a copy of the arrangement of molecules and literally just moved it over on paper, the theory was you had to be able to find that repetition somewhere. That's called translational periodicity, repetitiveness. Well, these quasi-crystals don't have that, but they have some form of symmetry. And it was thought, well, they can't exist until someone went along and proved they did. But anyways, that's related to this idea that solids have some kind of geometric structure to them. If you don't have that, what kind of solid is that? What's the term for that? None of you ever got that in your chem classes? My 1A students never got that. Amorphous.
A few solids do form that kind of pattern.
Sulfur, for example, can have an amorphous form where there's really just totally random arrangement of atoms. It's the exception, not the rule, though. Most solids are crystalline. The reason why I wanted to get to this idea that most solids are crystalline is so we can talk about, well, what happens when something melts.
So highly idealized, we might have a drawing for a solid like this,
where if we imagine the molecules are rod-shaped, they'll try to pack together as closely as possible. Yes? Blurry? Let me see if I can fix it. Any better? Let me see if we can focus this too. So, in a crystalline solid, you'll have some kind of ordering of the molecules. What happens when a solid melts? What's going on? Molecules are spreading apart, bonds are breaking. Are bonds breaking? No. And for my 1A students, you've heard this rant before, but bonds breaking is a chemical change. Melting is a physical change. Doesn't necessarily have anything to do with a chemical reaction. What you meant, and I totally understand this, what you meant is that the associations between molecules are breaking down. These intermolecular forces that we talked about, something is overcoming them. But there's a difference between a force and a bond. That IMF, the intermolecular force, is just an attraction. But if you really had bonds between molecules, you'd just have one big, huge molecule, because that's what bond means. So just got to be very careful when I ask you about melting on your lab quiz, that melting does not involve any bond breaking. Melting occurs when thermal energy, the fact that at room temperature or any temperature, molecules are wiggling around. Melting is when that thermal energy overcomes the ability of the intermolecular forces to keep molecules stuck together.
I'll say that backwards. When thermal energy, which means internal kinetic energy, exceeds the ability of the intermolecular forces to hold molecules together, a phase change occurs.
Yes?
What's the box?
The box is just representing a crystalline solid. So now how do we physically do this process of measuring a melting point? Well, how many of you have not used meld temps, specific type of machinery that we use for doing melting points? Has anybody in here not used a meld temp device? Well, just in case you're not sure if you have or not, you're going to see them momentarily. And by the way, to check out the meld temps, you'll just go to the stock room. They've got those available.
But to vastly simplify, a meld temp looks like this.
You're going to have a base that contains the heating element. That heat is transmitted up through the apparatus, where part of it is an observation window, so that when you stick your samples in, you're going to be watching to see if it melts or not. And then, of course, you've got the thermometer that gets stuck at the top of the device. Why am I worried what this device looks like? Well, because there's this idea of thermal equilibrium. So if you have a hot object and a cold object, what goes on when they contact? Well, the hot object's got molecules that are moving quickly. The cold object's got molecules that are moving slowly. And what happens is that the hot molecules, the faster moving molecules, bump into the slow ones, and just from the fact they collide into each other, at some point they all wiggle with the same amount of energy. But that is a physical process that therefore takes time. So thermal equilibrium is a state in which the molecules all have the same average energy, but it takes time to achieve that. And here's the point then. If I was impatient, as a student I might be tempted to be, and I wanted to get this melting point over with a hurry because I was bored, I might be tempted to turn the heat all the way up on the melt temp device. If I did that, what's going to happen to the temperature reading I might get? In this specific case, where here's the heating element, then your samples go somewhere about here, and then you've got the thermometer up above. What specifically will happen data-wise if you were to take a melting point with this setup, but you had the heat turned up too high? Will your melting point change? The answer is no. Your observation of the melting point will change. Melting point doesn't change just because your heat source changes. What you see changes. So, will you observe a change in the melting point? Will it go up or go down? You got three choices. Which one is it?
It'll go up.
So if I have a vote for up, more votes for up. Anyone voting for down? Are you following the herd?
Move.
Goes down. Why? Well, somebody had to guess. At least you were brave enough to guess, right? That's all I'm looking for, is someone to try to make some intelligent choices. What made you think it would go up? What was your logic?
Because as the heat goes up, it'd be harder to get an exact melting point.
Okay.
And you pass your melting point with heat, but by the time you looked at it, it actually already melted.
You're exactly right, but that means your answer should be backwards. That, yes, what's going to happen is the heat will not have made it up to the thermometer in time, but your sample will have already melted. So that means the thermometer will be at a lower temperature than what your sample will be when your sample melts. So your logic is right. It just means, again, the answer is backwards. Because it takes time for that heat to travel, because thermal equilibrium takes a while to establish. If your thermometer is further away from the heat source, then as this heat is radiating on up, the sample melts, but the thermometer hasn't been heated up enough yet. I want to emphasize this because it has nothing to do with how much heat is being put in. That does not change the melting point. But because this is a physical system that takes time for heat to travel, that's why things appear to change. So in this particular experiment, If a solid is heated too rapidly when measuring melting point,
The melting point will appear too low, since not enough time was given to allow the thermometer to reach thermal equilibrium. Which is a condition which all molecules have the same average energy. So ideally, we would heat a system up for melting point 1 degree per minute. And there are machines that are automated that can do that for us. But that does present a real life problem. Because did anybody look up yet the melting point of benzoic acid, happen to see it? Yes. 122. 122 to 123, depending which source you look up. But if we're at room temperature, somewhere around 20, 25 degrees, and if you followed what I just said, that means it's going to take 100 minutes to complete your melting point. And we don't have that time, and I wouldn't ask for that much patience. So what can we do? Yeah.
In some way, can we speed it up to about 115?
I wouldn't go that close, but you got the right idea. If we know the compound we're supposed to have, if we know it's supposed to melt at 120 degrees, why wait an hour as we're heating to 21, and then 22, and then 23, when nothing's going to happen until you're well above 100? So, yeah, crank it up at first. Turn the heat up high. But then as you're getting to 100 degrees, slow way down. Depending on how high you turn it, if you take me too literally and you turn it to the maximum setting, realize that that thermal equilibrium means there's a time lag. So even if you pull the plug and turn the power off, there's still heat radiating. And so the temperature will continue to rise even once you turn it off. But do it carefully enough, you can get up to 100, 105 degrees, and then slowly heat. If you got up to 105 and then went 2 degrees a minute, it's only going to take you 10 minutes to do a melting point, which is not too unreasonable. If we didn't know the identity of the solid, what could we do?
Look it up on Google.
Okay, look it up. But we didn't know what it was, period. Not just not how does it not behave, but we don't even know what it is. You do the same thing. Crank it up. Just realize that when you see it melt, that's going to be too low. And then you do it again. But let's say if it melted at 160, then slow down at 150 or 140. Because you know whatever the real temperature is has to be higher. Since we know it's 122 or a little below, which is the last thing I need to get into. Since we know it's going to be around 122, heat rapidly up to about 100. Again, by the time you turn it down and let things stabilize, you're going to end up with about 105, 110. Then if you go really slowly, you get a nice, accurate melting point. Why do we care about getting a nice, accurate melting point? Because it tells us something about the purity of the sample that we just made. Now, it is one of the most rudimentary techniques. We would never use melting point all by itself to prove anything in a scientific journal, at least not most of the time. Because we have much more sophisticated ways of verifying a compound's identity. But back in the old days, 100, 200 years ago, melting point was one of the main ways that we did things. So historically, that's why we're still carrying melting points around, because there have been so many compounds that have had their physical properties tabulated. But purity, what I'm getting at is that if you get a melting point of 122.4, it means you have benzoic acid. If you get 120, there's two choices of what that means.
You did it too fast. You were in too much a hurry, so you had this thermal equilibrium effect. Or you had an impurity. Why does having an impurity cause the melting point to drop? Yes.
Continue that. You're right. The state was made. If you put an impurity in there, you're going to interrupt this internal structure of the crystal. What does that cause? What does that do to the intermolecular forces between different molecules in that crystal? It weakens them. And if it weakens the intermolecular forces, and melting is the point where you get over those intermolecular forces, if you lower your target, then you don't have to put as much energy in. By disturbing the crystal structure of a solid, it makes the molecules, the attractions between molecules easier to overcome, which means less energy has to be put in, and so the melting point is lower. This is melting point depression. One of your topics from Chem Point 1B.
So picture-wise, it would look something like this. And this is an extreme example, but it gives you the idea that parts of your solid are really, really well packed still. But every once in a while, you've got this impurity that's snuck in there. Technically, if we're talking about solutions and we're talking about colligative properties, we should be very careful to say that the solute and solvent are the solute and solvent, that there's solubility going on. But in this case of your crystallization, what can happen is that water, even if it's not soluble, might get trapped as part of the crystal structure. Of course, in Chem 1A, we call that a hydrate. But you might have some water going along the ride for with your benzoic acid. That's why, hopefully, you finished your crystallization last time, so you had this whole past weekend where we're sitting around air drying, so hopefully you don't have that water. And some people must have had success because there were a number of people that did get melting points of 122 this morning. So not only did they make the compound or isolate the compound correctly, but they also did not rush the melting point. Now, I just got a little lost there. Oh, yes. The diagrams to show that the molecule is interfering. So because that impurity interferes with the intermolecular forces and decreases them, not as much energy is needed to overcome them, which means melting occurs at a lower temperature. Now, that brings up some important points. How do we know something's melted? What are we observing? Well, most of you said that you had used melt temps before, or if not, you'll probably remember as soon as you see one. But you'll have a sample that you're going to load into what's called a microcapillary, basically a really tiny, itty-bitty test tube. You'll take the single open-ended capillaries. So be careful, because you might have two types over there. Single open-ended means the other end's closed, so that when the stuff starts to melt, it doesn't just dribble into the machine. So you take the open of that capillary tube and carefully tap it into the solid sample, which means you're going to get the top portion of that tube filled up with the solid. You can then use one of these. It's just a hollow glass tube where you'll put the tube on your benchtop and drop the closed end of your sample down and let it bounce. It just happens to be that roughly that shock of bouncing from that height is about the amount of force you need to get that solid to go down into the bottom of your capillary. Some solids might not work as well. You might have to manually do it. They just might be a little more resistant. But that's the easiest way to load the samples, and no one came up with problems this morning, so I'm presuming that it worked for everybody to do it that way. That little capillary, there'll be an observation window and a place to put your sample in there, and then you're going to watch your sample as you increase temperature. Now, this comment I made about a compound possibly incorporating some water, around 90 or 100 degrees, you might see your sample do what's called sweating, which means liquid will appear to start to form, but it won't be the whole sample that starts to melt. It's just water possibly coming out. So you might see it crinkle a little bit. You might see it change its translucency just slightly, but then to continue to stay the same. So again, that's that sweating phenomenon where it's just water coming off. When it really melts, you'll see the whole darn crystal start to crumble and to liquefy, to move, to become more transparent. But even if you're doing it really carefully, you might not see just one temperature at which it melts. And that's because in a real crystal, because you might have molecules slightly differently arranged, some might melt before the others, but over a very narrow range. So from the temperature your sample starts to melt till when you see the last bit convert to liquid, that's the melting point range. And yes, you should mark both the beginning and ending temperatures down. Once you've melted a sample, if you need to make another melting point, which For this lab, just to cut down on the amount of work that we've got, if you do it well, if you do it the way I've described, where by the time it melts, you're going slowly up in temperature, you only need to do melting point once. You don't need to do a confirmation melting point. We should, as good scientists, we should be doing it multiple times. But we're going to run out of time as it is. So just because it's a case of practicality here, we're only going to do one melting point. But if you needed to repeat it because you messed up, you heated it too fast, you didn't see it melt, whatever the reason might be, you have to make a fresh sample. Because although it won't happen likely for benzoic acid, it is possible for some solids to melt, freeze, and then melt at a different temperature than it did the first time. And that can happen if once it melts, the molecules rearrange compared to what they were in the solid originally. Generally, that only happens with polymers, systems with very, very large molecules. But since I'm trying to teach you general technique, that means in general, you got to toss your sample after you melt it. These little capillaries, the glass, that can go into the waste bottles. It is fine for solid to be put in a bottle labeled liquid, but not the other way around. So your samples, because they're all acids, just dump them into the acid waste, glass and all. Any questions what you need to do? Then let's get to work.